Imagine it. 1919. The war is over. The doughboys are home. And somewhere in the middle of America, a big open field, a crowd of 1,000 people who have never been closer to an airplane than a newspaper photograph. Then the engine starts. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we're going back to the moment. Aviation stopped being something you read about and started being something you could buy a ticket to see. We're going back to the summer the Jennies came home and turned every pasture in America into a gateway to the sky. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Here's the setup. When the armistice was signed in November of 1918, the United States Army Air Service had somewhere around 10,000 aircraft sitting on fields and in hangars, most of them barely used. Training schools had churned out pilots by the thousands, and almost overnight, there was nothing left to do with any of it. The government moved fast. By 1919, surplus aircraft were being auctioned off at prices that would make your jaw drop even a century later. A Curtiss JN4, what everybody called the Jenny, went for anywhere from $200 to $500, a complete Jenny. With an OX-5 engine, ready to fly, for context, a good automobile cost about $500 in 1919. A new house in a mid-sized city was $3,000 to $4,000. A Jenny at $200 was not cheap, but it was not impossible. It was in reach for a successful farmer, for a small businessman, for a group of veterans who pooled their discharge pay, and they bought them. The Curtiss JN4 had been the backbone of American military flight training since 1916. By the time the war ended, the United States and Canada had built more than 6,000 of them. The airplane came from a Curtiss engineering team working alongside a British aviation designer named Douglas Thomas, and what they produced was, by any honest standard, an unremarkable aircraft made remarkable by circumstance. It was not a fast airplane. Top speed around 75 miles an hour. Cruise closer to 60. Ceiling of around 6,500 feet with a full load, less on a hot summer afternoon in the flatlands. The OX-5 engine was a 90-horsepower water-cooled 8-cylinder that was mechanically honest in the specific sense that it told you exactly what was wrong with it, loudly and often. The valves leaked, the magnetos were sensitive to moisture, and the engine ran on castor oil, which meant the slipstream carried a fine mist of it back into the open cockpit and onto everything the pilot owned. Old-timers who flew Jennies talked about the smell for the rest of their lives. Castor oil and dope. The nitrate lacquer sprayed on the fabric covering. Warm engine and exhaust mixing into the cold morning air, it was the smell of an era. But here's the thing about the Jenny that made the barnstorming years possible. It stalled gently and recovered gracefully. In the hands of a reasonably competent pilot, it was forgiving in a way that the high-performance machines of that period were not. For 1,000 former military pilots trying to make a living with the only skill they had, that forgivingness was worth more than any specification in the flight manual. You sat in an open cockpit, no windscreen to speak of. Wind blast at 60 miles an hour directly in the face. Cold at altitude even in summer. No radio, no weather service worth mentioning. Navigation was a roadmap folded into your knee pocket and whatever landmarks you could identify on the ground below. The Jenny had two cockpits, student up front and instructor behind, and in the barnstorming days, the passenger rode up front, where the instructor used to sit, bracing themselves against the slipstream with both hands on the cowling rail. Now here's where it gets interesting. By the summer of 1919, you had thousands of trained pilots with nothing to fly. You had thousands of surplus Jennies available at prices ordinary Americans could almost afford. And you had a country that had spent 4 years reading about aerial combat in the newspapers, about the Lafayette Escadrille and Eddie Rickenbacker and the aces of the Western Front, and was deeply curious about what flight actually felt like from the inside. What happened next was almost inevitable. They went barnstorming. The term itself came from political campaigning. Candidates who made rapid-fire speeches across rural districts were said to barnstorm the countryside. The pilots borrowed the word and made it their own. They would fly into a town unannounced, or sometimes with a little advance word placed in the local paper, circle low over Main Street to announce their arrival, then land in the nearest flat pasture. The farmer whose field they chose was usually compensated in cash or in a free ride, which took care of most of the trespassing concern. Then they sold tickets, $5 a head in the early years. The cost of a decent dinner in a city restaurant, enough to give a man pause, not enough to stop him if he had been dreaming about the sky his entire adult life. Picture a small town in southern Ohio in the summer of 1920. Population maybe 1,500 souls. The biggest event of the previous year was the county fair. Then somebody on Main Street hears an engine overhead, not a distant rumble, but close and getting closer. And there it is, a biplane with white linen wings, circling at low altitude, waggling its wings, then banking away toward the Pemberton farm east of town where the ground runs flat. 1,500 people materialized at that pasture. Not all of them, maybe, but enough. Farmers who had left their equipment idling in the next field. Storekeepers who had flipped their clothes sign without a second thought. School children who had simply begun walking in the direction of the sound. They came because they had never seen anything like it up close, and some instinct in them understood they needed to. The barnstormer would set up his operation. If he was working alone, the routine was simple. A demonstration pass first, low and slow, to let the crowd get a look at the airplane. Then something to establish credentials, a loop, a chandelle, a wing over that brought the crowd's collective breath in short. Then someone with a good voice and a natural gift for working a crowd would start selling tickets, and the show would begin. The first passengers were always an event unto themselves. They would climb up into that front cockpit wearing whatever they happened to have on. A Sunday hat became a problem the moment the pilot pushed the throttle forward. Scarves launched into the prop wash, eyeglasses carefully removed and tucked into a breast pocket for the duration of the flight, then fumbled back onto a frostbitten face on landing. And those passengers would climb out changed people. That is not sentiment talking. Pilots who flew passenger rides in those years described the same reaction over and over. People would land and simply stand there for a moment, not saying anything, just standing. Then they would go find whoever they had come with. A husband, a daughter, a lifelong friend, and begin talking, trying to describe something that resisted description. The view, the town from above. How small everything looked from up there, how large the sky was, how quiet it seemed, even with the engine running, because the experience was so overwhelming, the brain simply stopped processing everything else. A remarkable number of those passengers went home and started reading about aviation. Some went on to become pilots themselves. Some of them when their children came of age and the next war was calling for airmen. Those children had grown up in houses where flight was real and possible and extraordinary. The barnstormer seeded a generation of American pilots, and that is not an accident of history. The economics of the operation were thin and growing thinner as the decade went on and the Jennies aged. The OX-5 had a habit of throwing a valve or fouling a plug at inconvenient moments. Every barnstormer carried a basic toolkit, baling wire, spare magneto points, a few yards of fabric, and a can of dope for patching tears. A field repair in a cow pasture in Kansas with borrowed tools and whatever parts you could source from the nearest farm supply store was not exceptional. It was weekly. Most barnstormers lived out of their aircraft, slept under the wings or in the barn of whatever farmer had taken them in, and ate at whatever roadside diner would extend credit to a pilot who promised to settle up when the next town turned out a good crowd. The best summer days could be genuinely lucrative. A large crowd, good weather, favorable word of mouth from the morning's passengers, and you might fly 60 or 80 hops in a day and clear more than a working man's monthly wage in a single afternoon. The bad days, the three-day rain that grounded you in a town where you had already sold every available ride, could erase weeks of margin in a single stretch. Some operations grew beyond the solo pilot with a single ship. By the early 20s, there were organized flying circuses, groups of three or four aircraft working together with dedicated performers added to justify higher ticket prices and pull bigger crowds from farther away. Wing walking had been part of exhibition flying since before the war, and in the barnstorming era, it became a staple attraction. A performer would climb out of the cockpit while the pilot held the airplane straight and level, work their way outboard along the wing bracing wires, and stand upright on the upper wing surface with nothing between them and the earth but their own grip and their own nerve. Parachute jumping drew enormous crowds. Car-to-plane transfers, where a performer climbed from a moving automobile up a rope ladder hanging from a flying aircraft, were almost guaranteed to stop traffic cold on whatever country road ran alongside the pasture. Women performed these stunts as well as men, and in several celebrated cases considerably better. Phoebe Fairgrave, who learned to fly in the early 20s and later married her pilot partner to become Phoebe Almley, was doing parachute jumps and wing walking before she turned 20 and went on to become the first woman to hold a transport pilot's license issued by the United States government. The barnstorming world shaped her, and she in turn helped shape what came after it. The accidents were real and they were visible. The barnstormers were working without any meaningful safety framework. Inspections were whatever the pilot could manage with his own eyes and hands before the first flight of the day. Aircraft structures were aging in ways their owners did not always recognize. Crowds stood where they should not have. The margin between a low showboating pass and a catastrophic structural failure was sometimes measured in inches and in luck. the federal government had been circling the question of aviation regulation since the end of the war. There was no framework at all. You could build any airplane, fly any airplane, carry passengers in any airplane, without a license or an inspection or a registration number. The Post Office Department had its own rules for the airmail service, but general aviation was unrestricted in a way that made insurance companies nervous and civic authorities in several cities increasingly vocal. The Air Commerce Act of 1926 was the beginning of the end for the true barnstorming era. It gave the Department of Commerce authority to certify aircraft and pilots, investigate accidents, and establish airways. For the first time, the government could say your airplane does not meet airworthiness standards and your pilot certificate is revoked. Not every barnstormer could pass the new tests. Not every aging Jenny could pass the new inspections. The economics were already marginal, and the regulatory requirements pushed some operators out entirely. The transition took several years. Some barnstormers adapted, got their ratings, upgraded their aircraft, found work at the fixed base operators beginning to appear near growing cities. Some moved into the organized airshow circuit that developed under the new rules. Some simply quit flying and went back to whatever they had done before the war. By the early 1930s, with the Depression squeezing every economic margin and the regulatory framework closing off the Wild West years, the era was genuinely over. But look at what it left behind. Between 1919 and roughly 1928, the barnstormers introduced flight to millions of Americans who would never have encountered it otherwise. Not in theory, not through newspaper accounts. In person, in an open field, $5 at a time on a Tuesday afternoon in a town where nothing much had ever happened before and nothing much would happen after. They built an appetite for aviation in rural and small town America that the airlines, when they finally arrived, would spend decades trying to satisfy. And they proved something that sounds obvious now, but was not obvious then. That flight was survivable for ordinary people, that the sky was not hostile or remote or reserved for the exceptional. That you could go up there and come back down and tell your neighbors about it over supper. Everything in American aviation that came after. The airline networks, the military aviation culture, the general aviation community we still fly in today, has the barnstorming era somewhere deep in its foundation. A flat pasture, 1,000 people looking up, and an OX-5 engine running on castor oil that smelled like a pharmacy and kept running one more day. My sources today include the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's collection on early American aviation and Roger Bilstein's book Flight in America. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the blue side up.